Hello, thanks for listening. All the music featured in the BBC series Top of the Pops playback and the Radio Luxembourg years has been faded out for podcast copyright reasons. However, the full versions of these programmes can be found on the Sean Tilly Archive Mixcloud channel. Hello, I'm Sean Tilly, and this is Top of the Pops Playback. Now, during the next hour, we'll be remembering a vintage edition of the world's most famous chart show with the help of one of the stars from that particular programme, and we'll be playing some of the big hit songs to feature in it, which at that time were Top of the Pops. Five different decades of TOTP history to get stuck into, and this music means we're back to the 80s. So, let's go hurtling all the way back to the 7th of February 1985 and appearing on that edition of the programme, performing what was then his new single, Things Can Only Get Better. It's a big welcome to Howard Jones.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you. As for this Top of the Pops, 7th of February 1985, it's an obvious question. I probably know how the answer's going to go as well, but do you remember much about this?
I remember a general feeling of being a bit nervous because it was the first single from the new album. Mm. You know, and you the first album had gone so well for me. Like, was I going to be able to keep it going, you know? And I was so that, you know, because I was 28 when I got signed. So for me, it was like, oh, blimey, you know, I've got this far. Can I keep going? And will I have a career? What will people think of the new stuff? So there was a bit of nerves going on.
You did all right, actually. Yeah. I think it's fair to say. Kicking off this edition of the show were King, who were climbing to number two with this single. It was Love and Pride. The 7th of February 1985, all over again on our Top of the Pops playback. Howard Jones appearing on the show, and what a great opener too, from their top 10 album Steps in Time, rising to number two. It's King and Love and Pride. What do you remember about them, Howard?
The main guy, what was his name?
Paul King.
Yeah.
With that long hair, long mane.
I always thought King had Paul had a great style and great look, and that was obviously a feature of this period of time in pop. And I met Paul many times because he was like an MTV producer.
That's right, he went on to be a VJ.
VJ, yeah. Very nice man, actually. And I probably met him for the first time. That was a great thing about Top of the Pops. You got to meet lots of people. Yeah.
Bit of camaraderie, particularly in those days.
Yeah.
And 7th of February 1985, Howard, just working out, probably just a couple of weeks away from your 30th birthday.
Yeah.
So it was a good time for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. You know, my life at that time was a complete roller coaster of activity. You know, there was no days off. It was either in the studio, on tour, doing TV, doing promotion, flying somewhere. And it was just relentless.
Let's go back, almost 18 months before this edition of The Pops, to the very first time you appeared doing New Song. What sort of memories do you have of that?
I was absolutely nervous. I mean, I'd watched Top of the Pops since I was 11, religiously, every Thursday night. To be actually on it, when I watch it now, I can see I'm just like chewing gum. I didn't have any gum, but it was nerves. It was the nerves, sheer sort of panic of it all. But it did go very well, and it really it ended up going to number three. You know, it was a huge jump. So that connection with the public was just immense, really.
I read somewhere that you'd record it on a Wednesday, Top of the Pops. I seem to recall reading that the following night when it was on TV, you were watching it backstage at a gig or something. You had a TV perched on an ironing board. Is that true?
Probably was. It probably was. It was like a surreal moment because it was like, is this actually happening or am I kind of dreaming about this? And it really was because, you know, you never think I could have got that far. And I did. And I suppose it's, you know, you've got to keep believing in yourself that you can do these things, you know, and there it was. We've kind of broken through, and now everywhere you go, everyone's going to know you. That was the shock that came after it, because that's what happened.
I remember you being one of the first people I think I'd ever seen on Top of the Pops that had the microphone attached to the earpiece. Mm. I remember you doing that. And, of course, the other memorable thing about that performance was your mime artist.
Yeah.
Jed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the, you know, the thing. We did make our mark with that. But it was a reflection of what we were doing live. I mean, that's how it was. I had the keyboards, the drum machines, all sequenced live, all you know, being manipulated live, and then Jed improvising his dance stuff. So that's what we did. It wasn't like a contrivance for Top of the Pops. That was the live show. And I think people really, really connected it with it being something a bit different, you know, and that's what we set out to do, and so it worked. You know.
Phil Collins was next on the show. He had a climber at number 12. The record was Studio.
I'm Sean Tilley here at the BBC with Top of the Pops Playback, and in this edition we are remembering the 7th of February 1985 with Howard Jones, and from his album No Jacket Required, that's Phil Collins. It was upwardly mobile at number 12 with Studio, and not long after this edition of the programme, you'd be working with Phil Collins.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think Studio is a really great track, actually. Very, very, sort of almost like Prince influenced, I thought. I thought he'd been quite influenced by that. I'd always been a big fan of Phil as a drummer. I think, you know, he's one of the best drummers we've ever produced. And because he had a solo career and all that, people tend to forget what a brilliant musician, you know, he is. So, yeah, and I got to work with him. It started off with being invited to do the Prince's Trust concert, so they got me into do keyboards. So I was with this superstar band, you know, Eric Clapton and
incredible
Phil Collins, and I mean Elton John. I mean, it was everyone was in those bands. So I got to know Phil through that. And when we, you know, put out the Dream Into Action album, and No One Is to Blame was, you know, being played around, the fans always liked that version, but I thought it could be good to go for it as more of a single and to try and re-record it, and Phil really loved the song and he was really up for doing it, so I ended up working with him.
Yeah.
And it became our biggest hit in the States. Was number one on radio in America, and so that was a really fabulous collaboration.
Going back right to the start of your chart career, we talked there before we listened to Phil about the impact of the first single, New Song. There was an incredibly quick follow-up when you think how quickly What Is Love was released after New Song.
Yeah.
What was the thinking behind that? Was it the record company saying, well, look, we've got an enormous hit here, we need to get another one out ASAP? Because I think, what was it, within about 7 weeks?
Yeah. I'd recorded New Song with another producer, and so that was a separate project in a way to the album. So that was out, and then the record company teamed me up with Rupert Hine to do the whole album, which was a brilliant choice. So we got in the studio and we recorded the album in 6 weeks because all the songs were there, and there was this incredible, you know, imagine you got a song in the charts, you know, going up the charts, and it was it was number three, and you know the momentum and the excitement of recording that album was incredible. So What Is Love, you know, came out early in that recording, and that was going up the charts while we were finishing off the album. So it was you can imagine, you know, the energy and the buzz, the excitement. You felt very confident about your work, that it was going to be heard, and that, you know, and the people were going to enjoy it. So it
turned out to be a good Christmas, that Christmas 83.
I mean the only slight disappointment was it didn't get to number one, because it was number one in the north of the country, clearly, but in the south it was like slightly was two, and I think it was down to 400 or 500 record sales in the end.
What would it have been? Pipes of Peace?
Yeah. The singles all sold over 500,000, and I had about, you know, 13 top 20s or something.
Yeah.
And so people, you know, I didn't sell the sort of numbers people sell of albums now, but the singles which are the things that go into your head and stay there. It's very interesting. That was my story for the UK, really.
And that was the inspiration for people to go out and buy the albums as well, you know. And they were all terrific pop records as well. I think that's the other thing. Kirsty MacColl was next on this edition of Top of the Pops on video, so she wasn't in the studio for this, Kirsty. It was up to number 13. It was her version of Billy Bragg's A New England. And it's memories of the 7th of February 1985. Top of the Pops playback, Howard Jones is my guest this time around, and Kirsty MacColl on video, rising to number 13, her version of A New England.
I don't think I've ever told this story, but I got invited to do some carol singing around London for charity. And Kirsty MacColl was one of the people who was part of our group. And we just got on this minibus and we just went around doing places like Selfridges and raised money for homeless people.
Yeah.
And so I got to meet her there and I really, really, you know, liked her. And it's tragic.
Awful.
Death.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I've got to know Billy Bragg quite well in recent times.
I remember when I heard his version of A New England, I think it would have been on John Peel's show, maybe 2 or 3 years before this. And then all of a sudden, Kirsty's done this version of a Billy Bragg song and totally transformed it. I think, you know, you're not somebody that's known for ever doing cover versions, but is that the secret of doing one too? I suppose you can go one of two ways, can't you? You can either sort of stay completely true to the original or offer something completely different. And she did that. She made that song her own.
That's right. And I think, you know, when you think of people who covered, like, Dylan songs, and then Dylan songs are kind of really... You'd hardly think there was much tune going on, but it's all about the lyrics. And then people cover it and sort of uncover and embellish the musical side.
I think Manfred Mann did that in the 60s quite a bit. They took a few Dylan songs, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the key to it. I mean, the only song I've ever covered was the one that was released as a single was a cover of a Donald Fagen track called IGY.
Yeah.
And I wanted to stick to the...
I remember playing that.
It was like he's my one of my idols in music. And I wanted to do a proper homage. I didn't want to change it. Mm. I wanted to do it just with me singing it, you know. I was listening to it recently because we just remastered all those tracks and... I'm really proud of it, actually.
Yeah, it was a great version of that. So I'm a massive Steely Dan fan myself, yeah.
I mean, people thought, who the hell does he think he is covering a Donald Fagen track, you know? But, you know, I was very aware of that. I spent a lot of time and care on it. And I think I did a respectful version.
You did. Were you a fan of the original run of punk music? You know, The Damned and The Clash and The Pistols to a certain extent?
I was a fan of the attitude. I'm not such a fan of the music. Mm. It was a bit too... You know, I came from... melody and chord shapes and you know, I was classically trained as a kid, you know.
I mean, this band came out of that whole sort of punk period, although I think, to be fair, they came from the second wave of punk. They were Killing Joke. They'd been around for about 6 years and finally had a top 40 single with this. It was a new entry at 32 and it was Love Like Blood, and a good record this as well. Pops playback, the 7th of February 1985, when Howard Jones was performing Things Can Only Get Better in the Top of the Pops studio. We have that song coming up very soon, but that was Killing Joke, a new entry at number 32 with Love Like Blood. Fantastic record. Great to hear that again. So, as you started to become more and more famous, a bigger star, as you started going global, becoming, you know, very, very successful in America, MTV loving you over there. I know initially your mum and dad were running the fan club. Were they still able to do this when you became so big?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to keep that very personal connection with the fans, and so my mum and dad did stay doing it, but we just needed to get more people. And so we had a team of about 7 or 8 people working full time. The fan club was always free, you know, you there was no question of you having to pay anything to belong to it. And I was very keen that when people wrote a letter in, that they got a reply and it was respected and that it was personal. And that's what we managed to do, you know, through that era. And I think still now people come up to me with letters written by my mother to them.
Yeah, nice.
And it's like, and it's really, you know, that's a great legacy, actually, to have.
This is a guy who knew how to make an entrance. Pete Burns, with Dead or Alive.
Yeah.
Who'd have ever thought that this record was going to end up as big as it did? Because it was a new entry at number 40, and it was, of course, You Spin Me Round Like a Record. You're listening to Top of the Pops Playback with me, Sean Tilley. And during this edition, we are rewinding to the 7th of February, 1985, when Howard Jones was limbering up for his performance. He's also sharing the memories with me. And a new entry at number 40 on the charts, Dot Aiken and Waterman's first ever number one. It was destined to be Dead or Alive, and You Spin Me Around Like a Record.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first time I heard it, I thought that's a monster hit. And it certainly, you know, and still to this day,
yeah,
you know, it's a classic pop record.
Dream Into Action eventually got to number 2 on the album chart in the UK, number 10 in the States, and it gave us stuff like, you know, Life in One Day and Look Mama as well. But the first track to be released from it as a single was the one that you were about to perform on this Top of the Pops. And again, proving your popularity in America, this was a number 6 record in Britain, but number 5 it got to on the singles chart in the States. Just give us an idea before we listen to it. Obviously, you're in the studio doing Top of the Pops, but you literally must have been, you know, in the States doing stuff and then whizzing back to the UK to do a Top of the Pops and then presumably back over to America again.
Yeah, I mean, it was always a big... because I'd lived in Canada when I was a kid, so I had a big connection with North America, and for me, it was very important to have success there as well. And so we kind of worked in Britain and America in parallel and did, you know, all the work you need to do. Playing the clubs and in America, going to all the radio stations, doing all that stuff, and it did pay off. You know, for me, what happened was my biggest album in the UK was Humans Live, but America it was Dream Into Action. So they really embraced that. You know, as you say, you know, it was a top 10 album. So it was a lot of flying back and forth, but you know. Great, wasn't it? It was a fantastic time. And I remember, you know, when we performed this on Top of the Pops with Aphrodisiac and Trevor playing the electronic Simmons drum kit and my brother on bass, and, you know, and the look of the whole band was like really fantastic. I must say, it had developed from just me and Jed to quite a large group.
Let's have a listen to Things Could Only Get Better. And, I mean, to get the highest new entry at number 18 in those days as well, that was pretty special, wasn't it? And as I mentioned, it got to number 6 in the UK, number 5 in the States. Great track. From the BBC, it's Top of the Pops on the 7th of February 1985. Howard Jones had just performed the highest new entry at number 18, heading for a peak of number 6 in the UK. Things Can Only Get Better. I've just realised something, actually, Howard. 5 months after this, it was Live Aid, and you were a big part of that.
Yeah.
What do you remember about the day?
Well, I remember... I've got quite a few memories of this. One was, we were in Germany doing a TV, and it was pretty much all the 80s crew, you know, doing this big German TV show, and they were talking about flying back to London to record a single, you know, and this thing called Band Aid. And I was definitely out of the loop with that. I mean, I was probably too busy or I wasn't connected enough to know about it. So they all did Band Aid. I should have being part of Band Aid.
Well, you were very much having hits at that time.
Yeah, but I wasn't. So when Live Aid came up, I was absolutely determined to be part of that. You know, and Geldof said, you know, the criterion is you have to have sold 1 million albums in the last year, and I'd easily done that.
Mm.
So I just got my manager to contact and get in touch with him, you know, and say, you know, we wanted to be part of it in whatever way we could. And so I was on tour in America, and we thought about doing Philadelphia, but really I wanted to do London because that's where, you know, this is where I come from. And so I cancelled two or three shows. Actually, left the band out there, came back and did it, and because I had no band, I did it on my own, you know, the piano, and that was quite scary.
But it was really, Freddie Mercury's piano, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And but it was a bit of a moment, you know, where you sort of think, well, look, I can hold an audience just on my own with the piano, and it was a great confidence build for me. Oh. And the audience joined in with the chorus, you know, when I sang it, and it was like, wow, you know, this is it doesn't get much better than this.
How many people again, roughly, in the audience?
There was 100,000 at Wembley, which was more than they should have had.
Yeah,
and then there was I don't know how many. A billion people watching on TV.
Well, here's somebody else who born in Trinidad originally, but we very much saw him as a British artist. Went over to America and, like yourself, got huge success over there. He was at number 16 on video, Billy Ocean, and this is Lover Boy.
The Pops Playback. My name is Sean Tilley, and for almost the last hour, thanks to our guest Howard Jones, we've been able to relive the 7th of February 1985 on video. Number 16 on the chart, that was Billy Ocean and Loverboy.
Well, it's so ironic that he should be on Top of the Pops the same time as me, because at the end of the 70s, I was at music college up in Manchester. I was at the Royal Northern College of Music studying piano. And I was invited to audition for a band, and it was Billy Ocean.
Was it?
And he was there, and I did meet up with him later and say, you considered me for your band. I can't imagine how different my life would have been if I'd have actually got the job or taken the job. I can't remember whether I was offered it or not. But isn't that ironic that he was on the same show as me and I was doing my own thing?
The number one record we get around to now. It was partly written by Tim Rice, Benny and Bjorn from ABBA, Elaine Page and Barbara Dixon. From Chess it was, wasn't it? And I know him so well. Eh?
Barbara Dixon covered What Is Love.
Oh, there we are then. So I've got something positive to say. Howard, thanks ever so much for sharing the memories with us.
Sean, great. Thank you very much. It's been a really interesting
trip back in time. Yeah.
It's really kind of digging deep there.
You can't beat memories, can you? Before we have a listen to the number one, though, it's a complete rundown of the top 10 for the 7th of February, 1985.
Climbing to number 10, The Out of Noise and Close to the Edit, but falling at 9, Strawberry Switchblade and Since Yesterday. Slipping to number 8, Tears for Fears and Shout, but moving up to number 7, it was Russ Abbott and Atmosphere. Also rising at 6, Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark, and dropping to number 5, Double A Side 1999 and Little Red Corvette, Prince. Up to number 4, it was Solid, Ashford and Simpson. Down from last week's number 1 at 3, Foreigner, I Want to Know What Love Is, but advancing at number 2, As High as They Got, King, Love and Pride. The first of 4 weeks on top of the chart, Elaine Page and Barbara Dixon from Chess, and I Know Him So Well.